Welcome back to another episode of The Adam Paradox. Today we are discussing an American analytic philosopher and Christian theologian, William Lane Craig. He holds faculty positions at Talbot School of Theology, Biola University, and Houston Baptist University. Craig has developed and defended the Kalam cosmological argument for the existence of God. He also focused in his published work on a historical argument for the resurrection of Jesus. His research on divine aseity and Platonism culminated with his book, God Overall. He has also debated the existence of God with public figures such as Sam Harris, Christopher Hitchens, Lawrence Krauss, and A.C. Grayling. Craig established and runs the online apologetics ministry, reasonablefaith.org. And if you're curious about what the Kalam cosmological argument is, it's a modern formulation of the cosmological argument from the existence of God, named for the Kalam, which is medieval Islamic scholasticism. It was popularized by William Lane Craig in his The Kalam Cosmological Argument in 1979. The argument is a variant of the unmoved mover in Aristotelicism. Oh my gosh, that's some of these are so hard to say. It is named for medieval Islamic scholasticism. I still can't say it. Scholasticism. I'm really struggling today. Arguing against the possibility of the existence of actual infinities, traced the idea to 11th century philosopher Al-Ghazali. Since Craig's original publication, The Kalam Cosmological Argument has elicited public debate between Craig and Graham Oppie, Adolf Grumbaum, J.L. Mackey, and Quentin Smith. There was an easy one. And has been used in Christian apologetics. According to Michael Martin, the cosmological arguments presented by Craig, Bruce Reichenbach, and Richard Swinburne are among the most sophisticated and well-argued in the contemporary theological philosophy. While also noting that in reference to Craig's argument specifically, there may have been trillions of personal agents involved in the creation. The Kalam argument's underpinning is the possibility of actual infinity, which is what distinguishes it from other cosmological arguments, such as that of Thomas Aquinas, which rests on the impossibility of an essentially ordered infinite regress, and that of Leibniz and Clark, I'm still not pronouncing that right, which uses the principle of sufficient reason. Now, many of these are very complicated topics, especially when you're trying to get into what's real, what's not real, and what's just kind of made up in philosophy and theology, which is kind of a counterpart of that. It gets really hard to identify what is true, what is not, and what is everyone talking about. So in this podcast, I'm going to kind of go through some of these things. I'm going to address what William Lane Craig says in some of his videos and just see how well we can go through this. For the form of argument, Craig states that Kalam cosmological argument is a brief syllogism, which means conclusion. It's a kind of logical argument that applies deductive reasoning to arrive at a conclusion based on two or more propositions that are asserted or assumed to be true. And some of the earliest syllogisms are defined in the Nya school of thought in a form defined by Aristotle from the combination of a general statement, the major premise, and a specific statement, minor premise, a conclusion can be deduced. For example, knowing that all men are mortal, major premise, and that Socrates is a man, minor premise, we may validly conclude that Socrates is mortal. Syllogistic arguments are usually represented in a three-line form. All men are mortal, Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates is mortal. Stepping back, again, we were talking about Craig states the Kalam cosmological argument as a brief syllogism. I just explained what syllogism was. Most commonly rendered as follows: whatever begins to exist has a cause, and the universe began to exist. Therefore, the universe has a cause. Now, the issue I have with this particular statement is, does the universe have a cause, and what does that imply? Because to me, that is a subjective statement. Now, the cause could be anything irrelevant to what we believe it is, or what we can contrive, think, or comprehend we think it is. It could simply just be to exist is the cause of the universe. that there is no other reason but to exist, and that is it. To live our lives the best to our abilities, be happy, and that's it. To survive, to thrive, that's the purpose, literally. And I could even be wrong on that because it's still an interpretation of what I think it could be. So whatever begins to exist has a cause is a subjective statement. However, that's solely all it could be. So the universe began to exist, therefore the universe has a cause. I can't agree with that, just up to the subjective reasoning on that. And I wanted to make sure I explained what I was interpreting when I read this, just so that, you know, anything comes up, we can talk about it. From the conclusion of the initial syllogism, he appends to further premise and conclusion based upon ontological analysis of the properties of the cause. The universe has a cause. If the universe has a cause, by the way, my interpretation is epistemistic or epistemological, not ontological. Ontological deals with actual information or numbers. The universe has a cause. If the universe has a cause, then an uncaused personal creator of the universe exists who sans the universe is beginningless. I'm going to say that meant to say says or says the universe is beginningless, changeless, immaterial, timeless, spaceless, and enormously powerful. Therefore, an uncaused personal creator of the universe exists who, I guess it is sans, the universe is beginningless, changeless, immaterial, timeless, spaceless, and infinitely powerful. Now, however, because it says the universe has a cause, we jump to the conclusion that it had to have a creator, an uncaused creator of the universe. Now, regardless of that, most of the time in religion, a creator usually means a person, thing, or substance that intelligently or decidedly coerced the change of natural occurrence. And that's why I don't agree with this fully. Transcending the entire universe, there exists a cause which brought the universe into being, ex nihilo, or our whole universe was caused to exist by something beyond it and greater than it. For it is no secret that one of the most important conceptions of what theists mean by God is creator of heaven and earth. So you can see how they all of a sudden jump to a conclusion. Again, nothing's actually real here. It's philosophical. And just because you can come up with it and think it and come up with a rational way to explain it, which is a good argument, by the way, it's a very good argument, doesn't mean it's any real. Just because you can figure out a reason, you know, or analogy, does it mean that it is? It's still based on the premise of evidence. Premise two, the universe began to exist. Cosmology and physics. Scientific confirmation, this is exactly what I was talking about. Scientific confirmation against a past infinity universe in the form of the second law of thermodynamics is one. Two, scientific evidence that the universe began to exist a finite time ago at the Big Bang. And three, the Borg-Guth-Willikin theorem, a cosmological theorem which deduces that any universe that has, on average, been expanding throughout its history cannot be infinite in the past but must have a past space-time boundary. And this is where they talk about folding time and space over and it collapses on each other. And in Big Bang Theory, it circles back into a single point and explodes, hence the Big Bang. Professor Alexander Willikin, one of the three authors of the Borg-Guth-Willikin theorem, writes, "A remarkable thing about this theorem is its sweeping generality. We made no assumptions about the material content of the universe. We did not even assume that gravity is described by Einstein's equations. So if Einstein's gravity requires some modification, our conclusion will still hold. The only assumption that we made was that the expansion rate of the universe never gets below some non-zero value, no matter how small. For eternal inflation, as an exemplar by which others disagree with Borg-Guth-Willikin theorem, in private correspondence with Stenger, Willikin remarked how the Aguirre-Grattan model attempts to evade a beginning by reversing the arrow of time at t equals zero, but that this makes the moment t equals zero rather special, I would say no less special than a true beginning of the universe." Again, these are all speculations, and this is what's going to be discussed in the video, most likely. I haven't heard this video. I don't pre-screen most of my videos, and we're just going to see where it goes and kind of work on it live as possible that you can do with a pre-recorded podcast.
As a springboard for our discussion today, I'd like you to ask yourselves the question, is the material world all there is? And today I want to sketch briefly seven aspects of the world which I think suggest that there are indeed more things in heaven and on earth than are dreamt of in naturalistic philosophy. Number one then, why anything at all exists. This is the deepest question of philosophy. Why is there something rather than nothing? This mystery, which according to Aristotle lay at the very root of philosophy, is one which even thoughtful naturalists cannot avoid. Derek Parfit, for example, agrees, and I quote, "No question is more sublime than why there is a universe, why there is anything rather than nothing." Now, experience teaches that everything that exists has an explanation of its existence, either in the necessity of its own nature or in an external cause. This principle seems quite plausible, at least more so than it's contradictory. Now, it's obvious that the universe exists. It therefore follows logically that the universe has an explanation of its existence. So, what sort of explanation could the universe have? Well, it seems plausible that three, if the universe has an explanation of its existence, that explanation is an external, transcendent, personal cause. Why? Because the cause of the universe must be greater than the universe. Think of the universe, all of space and time. So the cause of the universe must be beyond space and time. Therefore, it cannot be physical or material. Now, there are only two kinds of things that could possibly fit that description. Either an abstract object, like a number, or else an intelligent mind. That is to say, an unembodied consciousness.
Did you already spot the bias? So he's saying there's a universe by which the cause is actually something greater than the universe itself, that it can't be material because of the cause is so much greater. Now, to me, that sounds like it's just replacing a word with there has to be like another entity or another place or space and time in order to give the cause any actual physical ramification in our mind. I mean, in comprehension, if you imagine a different thing beyond here, you're still imagining another time and space in comprehension. So all it's doing is replacing here, I got this scientific philosophy crap, and then I'm going to put God in there, or I'm going to put whatever I want in there that is beyond anything we can comprehend physically in this reality. Now, again, you put the premise on there that says because the universe exists, it has to have a cause. And the cause is what I interpret to be greater than existence alone. That's kind of the issue. And when these things are said and we don't learn to decipher these quickly, we fall into the trap very easily and go, oh my gosh, he's so smart. That's right. I mean, I can't really think about it at the moment, but beyond my comprehension, yeah, I mean, oh, he might be right. This is very intense. What do I do now? You know, so you just kind of go along with the flow because you're like, I can't comprehend it. He's smart. He can comprehend it. He sounds very convincing. I might as well go along with it. Now, I don't personally agree that because the universe exists, it has to have a cause, and if because that cause is greater than the universe, then it must be by some intelligent designer. My arguments kind of come from a common sense logic of, in Genesis, God spoke everything into existence. Okay, why did he have the need to speak? If there was no one else to speak to, how did he know of all these things to create? How did he know that matter needed to be created if there was none? Like, what else? How would he know all the sciences of the earth that we have, that we are discovering, if it hadn't even existed yet? Existence means the very, very beginning. That nothing prior existed to that. Even if it was just time and space, and that was all that existed. Okay, where did he envision matter? Now, originally, in order to have a creator, you got to already have some sort of substance that is already created. That is a scientific fact. Most artists already have paint and a paintbrush, or they have a chisel and a hammer, or they have hands that mold clay. Like, something is, or clay, they have clay. Something's already there. And we see that argument in Genesis, as well as in many other religions. God created everybody from clay and a rib. I find that highly unlikely. And the reason why is because clay doesn't hold half the natural materials for DNA and RNA. And I get in this debate very often with very many people. And recently, one of them was I believe, a Muslim or an Islam or something like that. And he was basically describing the Quran. And they go, the Bible is true because of embryology. And embryology is where it's kind of like the study of eggs and sperm and shit. Maybe actually shit. I don't know. Anyways, and they believe that because, oh, the Bible was so accurate about it back in the 7th century, the Quran, that it has to be true. How else would they have known? So the argument for a lot of these things is because this happened and this happened that's unexplainable, then God has to be true. And they do that a lot. And it's a very annoying conversation. But nucleotides are the monomers, building blocks of nucleic acids, DNA and RNA. Each nucleotide includes three components, a phosphate, a sugar, and a nitrogenous base. Now, these are not found. All these are not found in clay. So unless there's clay somewhere with all these, you know, there. The phosphate is bonded to the sugar through phosphodiester bonds and makes up the backbone of the molecule. The nitrogenous bases form the rungs of the ladder and are connected through hydrogen bonds. The phosphate is the same in DNA and RNA, but the sugar can be a ribose for RNA or a deoxyribose for DNA. The latter is a ribose with one oxygen and oxy. There are four available nitrogenous bases in a DNA's nucleotides: adenine, thymine, guanine, and cytosine. RNA nucleotides feature the same bases with the exception of uracil, which replaces thymine. Do you see the difference? Do you see how unlikely it is that Eve was created from a rib? And that Adam was created from clay. Not to mention the way we look at each other and how we're so different among families and among generations. The only consistency is the traits that are handed down in generations. So if we all were descendants of Adam and Eve, then we would all bear very similar and same traits. And actually, we wouldn't likely survive in some of the areas that we have. We wouldn't be able to survive in hot climates. We wouldn't be able to survive in cold. We'd likely be gathered in certain areas, but the food would die out so quickly that we would just die because there'd be nothing left to eat. Thaler, in a recently published peer-reviewed article, states that it is possible there were 39 different either species or races of Homo sapien. And this was a near 60,000 years ago. Now, what this does is explain the ability to survive in different environments geographically, to cohabitate, to be able to, you know, interbreed and all these things that allow us to pass on traits of adaptability, of previously adapted abilities, and allow micromutations to take form. That's how we've gotten to this area in our intelligence and into our life. Each little new thing that was made or invented, every time a wheel was, or every time a new piece of technology was made, it passed down the intelligence and knowledge to the next generation. And then that was built upon. So are we really smart? I mean, that's kind of more of a semantics. But let's say we learn today at a 20% rate, but from 1965 to 1985, due to the advances in technology, they learned at a 55% rate. Then that explains, you know, the intelligence gap or how we have gone to evolve in our intelligence. Now, one of the other things is that we evolved over time, adapting to our environments to survive. If we had an Adam and Eve creation theory, or were created, they not only were not, they wouldn't have had the right molecules to even make life. So it would have to be a miracle from God to pull it off. Or if it happened naturally, it didn't happen at all because it didn't possess any of the right elements. Now, if the Bible wanted to be right with science, it would have said, now God took multiple forms of clay from different areas, added a sticky ribo sugar thing, and breathed into it life. Which still doesn't make sense, but I mean, at least it'd be a lot more accurate, and we'd be arguing a far more sophisticated debate on how the hell did they know that, that he needed all these other elements to make exactly this. Because this is not new, old information, this is new information. We just recently kind of found out that we can rebuild the building blocks for human DNA and RNA, simply by combining these elements and adding a phosphate. They've done actual tests and then confirmed that there is DNA and RNA in it. I kind of lost track where it was. So I was arguing with a Muslim, and basically I go, so how do you account for that, for the Adam and Eve thing? How do you account for all the different races and all the different things and traits and character characteristics? And he goes, there was multiple colored dust. There is multicolored dust. That's how you get different races. So apparently Adam and Eve were multicolored. I don't know. But he truly believed this. And he truly said that I'm an idiot if I don't believe in God. The, you know, the one of Allah. So that was his rebuttal.
But abstract objects can't cause anything. The number 7, for example, has no effect upon anything. And therefore, it follows that 4, the explanation of the universe, is an external, transcendent, personal cause. That is to say, there exists an unembodied mind which created the universe, which is what most people have traditionally meant by the word God.
So again, we see that he's taking one thing and applying a different meaning to it. That because something is abstract, because we can think it, therefore, it also has to have an existence apart from our brain. In other words, but that's what I would ask. So apart from our brain, how do you know that we have anything abstract to make a sufficient element of anything that suggests it's real? In other words, how do we know that what we think up or what we thought is real? I mean, I can think of fairies. I can have hallucinations of fairies. I can think about fairies being in a heavenly place. I can think about them being in a terrible place. And I can think about fairies in space for no absolute reason at all. It doesn't make it real, even though it's abstract. So the implication is a jump. It's a jump to conclusion that because this, then this is also true. In other words, it should be because this is also, you know, like what it would lead to in imagination land or something. So imagination and thought does not equal reality. And that's something that is a part of reality. That is something that, and again, philosophy is like really having a degree in make believe. I swear to God, I have so many arguments with philosophers, and it's really just like, hey, let me make some stuff up and then debate it. And here, let me defend it because, you know, because the number 7 is abstract, then we can say that pigs fly. You can say it. Doesn't make it true.
Have you ever asked yourself where the universe came from?
All the time, but I'm not so concerned with it because we're here. And I don't need any cosmological argument to know that God is fake or that I need to save myself and soul for a place in heaven because heaven isn't real. And I'm not saying that just to be, you know, the pessimistic, I think is the word. I'm saying it because despite the philosophy of these kind of arguments, nothing makes heaven real. Except for actual evidence or physicality, then heaven is. If the universe existed, for what cause does it need a separate existence? For what cause did it need another existence of? Like, this is it. So I could propose the same question. If the universe exists, there does not need to be another cause for existence. In other words, then, therefore, the universe exists only as it does, for no other reason.
Was there a beginning to the universe? Or does it just go back and back forever? Typically, naturalists have said that the universe is just eternal and uncaused, and that's all. But there are good reasons, both philosophical and scientific, to doubt that this is the case. As the physicist P.C.W. Davies says, the coming into being of the universe, as discussed in modern science, is not just a matter of imposing some sort of organization upon a previous incoherent state, but literally the coming into being of all physical things from nothing.
Now, I think it's safe to say a lot in philosophy and theology is to assume that nothing, everything came from nothing. And that's what the religious argument makes. God spoke everything into existence, which is everything coming into existence from nothing. However, I don't believe that. I kind of think that we came from something because all evidence and observations show that we did. And I don't think that the universe had to have a beginning or an end. I think that's very interesting to assume. It's also interesting to assume that our universe is on the level or scale of only what we see, even though that seems pretty infinite and expansive. However, what that kind of proposes is that there is an end or a beginning of the universe. Actually, what I'm implying is that there is a overlap of the universe. In other words, because the space and time is like fabric, and you can overlap it on top of each other and then create what's called a wormhole, you have the same idea that, in other words, if you had multiple stacked ripples or layers of fabric, that then you get into quantum theory and all this other stuff. But we're just one area of many other spaces, is what the issue is. But because it's so big, we're so small, it's a perspectively hard one to grasp. But imagine you had a pile of clothes. You're just one little spot in that. But you can't see the other sides. That doesn't mean that there's other dimensions. Just means that the way we are viewing the universe is limited to our perspective. And until we have the tools to be able to see beyond that, we may not be able to see that we're in a hamper of clothes. Just my analogy of that.
In fact, in the year 2003, three cosmologists, Arvin Bord, Alan Guth, and Alexander Vilenkin, were able to prove that any universe, which is on average in a state of cosmic expansion throughout its history, cannot be eternal in the past, but must have a past space-time boundary. So, why does the universe exist instead of just nothing? Where did it come from? There must have been a cause which brought the universe into being. We can summarize the argument thus far as follows. Premise one, whatever begins to exist has a cause. Two, the universe began to exist. Three, therefore, the universe has a cause. Given the truth of the two premises, the conclusion necessarily follows.
Yes, if the premise is that it does have a cause, you have to then prove it has a cause. And if you can't prove it has a cause, then all you have is still made up philosophy. It's just, it's a possibility it could happen, but that doesn't mean it did. The issue here is that if we can test for certain things, in other words, we know certain things have been wrong in the past. In other words, we know that we didn't come from clay, that we actually came from probably like rock-like materials and a sugary, you know, ribonucleic acid and a phosphate. We came from different materials than clay. So, in other words, because we're basing the universe's cause on a religious bias, does not mean that therefore it does exist. And philosophy and science don't really go hand in hand. Okay, it does to the sense of there is a science of philosophy and there's a philosophy of science. But that doesn't mean that anything we derive out of philosophy means it's scientifically proven. That's like saying anything I think up in my mind is therefore proven. It can be if I make it, but it can't be if I can't do it with the laws of physics or the laws of logic by which we are bound to. And there's no escaping that. There's no escaping those abilities. There's no escaping this reality. There's no quantum alternate universes. I don't believe there's any alternate universes. There could be, but I highly doubt it. And the reason why is because it's a thought concept. It's not a real concept of or a reality-like concept. And if the world is structured like that, which it could be, that's very interesting. But then again, because there's a cause for all that does not mean there's a creator for all of it. It simply exists because it does. Thank you for listening to today's podcast. If you have any questions or want to leave some feedback, hit the comment section on any of my social platforms or podcast platforms. And I'm looking for a guest for tomorrow's show about the R. Kelly thing. If you are interested, please drop me a line. I would like to have some extra dialogue on the show, and I think you'd be great for it. That is the next episode to come up. And if you like talking and debating about religion and other things, also drop me a line. Love to have you on the show and discuss what's going on with our universe, much like we did today. Thanks again for listening. Have a great rest of the week. Enjoy the weekend. Be safe. Enjoy the rain and thunder and lightning if you're in Southern California. And if you're in all